is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor. Zorba here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, this is a great time to give us a call at 1-800-462-7413. And of course, Zorba, along with our listener calls, some interesting topics to talk over.
Yes, doctor shortages, nurse practitioners, where do they all fit into the new healthcare system? And what does it mean to state legislators? And what does it mean to nurse practitioners who are out there? We'll talk about some interesting data that's coming up about that.
And?
Tannaholics. Is going to the tanning booth the same as other addictive behaviors? We'll talk about some interesting issues concerning tanning, whether it's healthy or not, of course, mm-hmm. and people
addiction.
Who tan.
Wow, interesting. Our recipe?
Tangy Italian potato salad. I love potato salad. And to make potato salad healthier, it means using less fat. This is a wonderful, delicious recipe. You'll want to try it the next time you grill.
800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. Let's get to the phone, Zorba. Welcoming a listener now in Plain, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi, Tom and Dr. Zorba. Thank you for taking my call.
We appreciate the call. How can we help?
Sure. My son is 14 months old and had a stroke in utero a few days before he was born. He's doing really well, and partly because we have a really fantastic group of therapists through our Birth to Three program, and we have a pediatric neurologist and a family practice doctor who has done everything that we've asked and more. So we're really grateful for all of the support we have, but I don't want to rule anything out. While we're doing OT and PT and speech therapy and all of the things we're supposed to be doing, I was interested in if there was any science to support acupuncture or yoga or any of the other alternative methods that would help him create that neural motor pathway to his right arm, because ultimately he forgets it's there, and that's kind of what we're hoping to avoid.
Really an interesting question, I think. Zorba, how unusual is this?
Well, it's not a rare event. It's not a rare event. I mean, it's something that is unusual, but it's not a rare event. So he had a stroke in utero. Do they know why that occurred, by the way?
They don't, but he was having he was still having active seizures right after he was born. So we are part of the, it isn't that rare anyway, but it is somewhat rare to know exactly what happened when it happened.
Right.
So
right.
We knew that he had a stroke within 15 hours of him being born.
Oh,
and we're able to start treatment
right
immediately.
Away. Right away. How's he doing, by the way? Does he sometimes use his arm, or he just ignores the arm?
Well, we've been through two rounds of constraint therapy where we basically mm-hmm. tie his left arm down and force right. him to use his right arm.
Uh-huh.
If he doesn't think about it, he mm-hmm. sometimes inadvertently reflexes and uses his right arm. But anytime he consciously makes a decision, he just doesn't know his right arm is there.
Right. You know, this is similar to what occurs when they said you tied the arm down with the lazy eye. You know, where one eye is favored over the other eye, and you patch the good eye so that you begin to use the bad eye, the eye that may have problems with people who have amblyopia. There's not been research on acupuncture. There hasn't been research on any of the issues that have to do with acupuncture and we'll say other therapies such as complementary and alternative medicine. So there's nothing out there. The most important research that we know about that concerns any neurological deficits in children is early intensive interaction with the child is critical. And it obviously you've got that.
Mm-hmm.
And sticking with ways of trying to determine which way to actually get getting that child to actually use the part of the body that's more difficult. I mean, it's easy for him to use one arm, and the other arm takes whatever it is. It takes a lot of power and concentration. So going through the restraint therapy, which must be very difficult and difficult for him also, and certainly difficult to you because, doing that is problematic, is probably the most important thing you can do.
Okay.
You know, that, I think, is the most important thing you can do. Just looking back on what occurs, we know, for instance, that parents who speak to their children appear to develop a greater vocabulary and a higher IQ than parents who don't speak to their children. Mm-hmm. So we know that with talking to children, it makes a difference in how brain power works. We know with sight, encouraging the bad eye to work makes the brain develop. So I'm sure it's exactly the same thing. And this is really using Mother Nature in the best fashion to try to develop these neural connections.
I'm really glad that you have that good medical care for your brain.
Absolutely. So how'd you find a crew like this and a team like this to work with you?
We have a really great relationship with our family practice doctor, who is actually both mine and my husband's and my daughter's, like our whole family. And when my son started having seizures, he came to us and he said, "I've never seen this before." And after we went through to a larger hospital and went through their NICU process, I had a really frank conversation with him, and I said, you know, I talked to our pediatric neurologist, and he said that you can still be the doctor, but I need you to make sure that it's okay with you, because this is a big deal.
Absolutely. And you know something? That's exactly where often you need a primary care person to be the captain of your team. Mm-hmm. And you've got a team of all these people, but you need somebody to integrate this together. And there's something called the medical home, which is this concept that's developing in primary care, where you have a home where it actually occurs, and then you have the various specialists that radiate out away from them. Keep up the good work. It's your interaction that means
and good luck with your boy.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for the call. And how fortunate are we to have Captain Zorba Pastor here through the rest of this hour and for many hours to come. 800-462-7413, our toll-free number. And a listener now with us, Zorba, in Nashville, Tennessee. Hello.
Hello there. How are you?
Fine. How can we help you?
Well, I have a problem, and I have a little bit of arthritis in my lower back. It's in my vertebra, and it's not that bad. It isn't painful or anything. But I have this numbness on my right leg. And if I looked at a clock, I would say it's between 2 and 3 o'clock, and it goes from my pretty much my hip to my knee. It's constantly numb at times in just small places, and sometimes it's numb all the way, the whole length of it.
My mind must have been wondering. You didn't say it always happens at 2 o'clock and goes on until 2:30, did you?
No. If you look at a clock, it would be that part of my leg.
Yeah. Okay.
Not every day.
Yeah, Tom is a clock guy. He always thinks about clock and time. So the numbness has been there for a long time. When you say many years, what actually started the numbness? Do you know?
No. Years ago, I was hit with a scalpel. I was taking it apart, and the wind blew. It was outside, and it knocked me off my balance, and this metal scalpel hit me in the center of my back between my shoulder blades. And it caused my left arm to go numb and was basically useless for a time being. But that was something totally different. I mean, I don't think that had anything to do with the leg. At times, I get these, like, pins and needles, like burning sensation in that same area. And sometimes it's painful.
Right. Let me tell you a little bit about numbness. You know, there are a number of the nerves that carry sort of the numbness sensation, and the nerves that carry the pain sensation can sometimes sort of get mixed up in the spinal cord and outside of the spinal cord, so that quite often people who have pain and discomfort often have numbness. In other words, because it's really affecting all of those nerves at the same time. Could be a disc, can be arthritis, can be spinal stenosis, where there's an increase in the bones, in the bony production in the back that actually then pushes on the nerve. But the final common pathway is that people complain about numbness and pain. And usually pain is more intrusive than numbness, but numbness is pretty intrusive. People go, it just doesn't feel right. Numbness that occurs and gets better in 6 months, we often don't care about. But numbness that goes on for years and years and years, there's not a lot that you can do to reverse it. In other words, the chances of it reversing spontaneously or with treatment are really close to zero, because what happens is you've had it's not necessarily nerve death, but that nerve is not working
properly.
Yeah,
but properly. It comes and goes.
Well, that just shows the nerve sometimes fires and sometimes does not fire. And that's the whole problem with it. We don't have a good way of dealing with it. Now, there are medications you can take that sometimes will tamp down the pain and discomfort. And for some people, that actually improves their sensation of numbness. Have you been on gabapentin, a drug called Neurontin, at all?
No, I've been on absolutely nothing, actually.
Now, when you talk about how much does it really bother you, would it bother you enough to take a pill three times a day?
At just certain times. It wouldn't, like right now, it's if I don't think about it, I don't even know it's there because I'm so used to it. At times when I'm sitting, and then the pins and needle sensation, and which, like I said, gets a little painful at times.
Okay.
Not outrageous. I mean, I can live with it like this. I just wondered if there was something that, other than, like you're suggesting, possibly some medication.
Yeah,
to take.
I mean, you wouldn't, for that amount of numbness, you wouldn't want to take that with side effects. One possibility is acupuncture. Acupuncture for some people can be very good either for chronic pain syndromes or for chronic numbness, which is really a variation of chronic pain. So one of the things I would do is I would get a good recommendation of a good acupuncturist in your area, and I would go for no less than 10 sessions. So that would be one issue that may work. The other issue, this is really where I would look at complementary and alternative medicine, is I would look at chiropractic.
For years I was going like once a month just to get adjusted.
Did that do anything for your numbness?
Actually, one time I went to a different type of therapist. It was and they what they did is they actually pressed on a tendon or a nerve between my groin and my hip, and they kept the pressure there for like 15 minutes. And just the guy just holding constant pressure on this thing for about 15 minutes. And what it did is it actually loosened my hip up so it would square up, and it seemed to make the everything better.
And so that's what I would look at too. I'd either go back to that chiropractor, I would look at acupuncture, and I would look at yoga. And the reason is yoga is a way of you're actually going through changing your ligaments, changing your joints, and basically seeing whether or not you can actually get this nerve to stop firing as much. And I would do that rather than take a pill because, frankly, a pill is three times a day and it has side effects and the numbness is not that bad all of the time. So I would try those things, and then if that doesn't work, give us a call back and we'll go from there.
All right. I appreciate it.
Yep. Thank you.
Appreciate the call. Thank you very much. 800-462-7413. You and I did a yoga thing once.
Yeah, we did do a yoga thing once for a fundraiser. Yeah. It was fabulous.
How many more yoga sessions have you had since then?
Zero.
Yeah,
zero.
Me too.
I'm going to zero yoga sessions. It's not my thing. I exercise three times a week, but yoga is not my thing.
800-462-7413. Before our next call, Zorba, you mentioned we're going to do a focus here on nurse practitioners with the coming health care changes. There's a concern about not as many doctors as we might need, and lots of states are considering expanding the roles of nurse practitioners.
So nurse practitioners are basically doctor extensions, and what they do is they often practice, in some states they practice independently, in other states they practice under the supervision of a physician. They see some of the common medical problems. They follow protocols of common medical problems. They work with and without their doctor, and they can often extend a doctor's practice so a doctor can spend time on the more complicated cases and they can do the simpler cases. And there's a total variation in different states. In some states, they can write prescriptions, do whatever they want to do, and in other states, they have to get an okay for some prescriptions. They have to have a doctor co-sign. And what a number of states are looking at expanding, 28 states are looking at expanding the nurse practitioner role so that they can actually engage in a lot of primary care.
Yeah, is this a good idea or not?
I think it's a great idea. I think it's a great idea. And I think what they really want to do is have nurse practitioners work in association with physicians. In other words, I think there should be some quasi-independence. They should work independently, but it's very important for them to pick up things that may be more complicated, not be able to actually do the training that they have, mm-hmm. and actually have another doctor as backup. And it doesn't matter if they're in primary care or in specialty care. Nurse practitioners are not trained as extensively as physicians, and so they can handle many, many of the common problems, but they can't handle the more complex problems.
So they can pretty much do a lot, maybe even all of the things that doctors do, but not exactly independent. independently. There need to be doctors around to supervise.
Yeah, I think there's a supervisory role. And once again, it's really for the cases that are more complicated that the nurse practitioner should be able to say, wait a minute, this is more complicated than I can handle. I have to go down to the doc, you know, either down the hall, or I'm going to talk to the doc on the telephone, or I'm going to do it through a web-based interaction. And I think that's really where it fits in. But within our medical office, we have a physician's assistant and a nurse practitioner. And in my office where I practice, they're great. They're awesome.
This is an hour show and we don't have a lot of time. Give me in a sentence, how much of a doctor shortage are we going to have under this healthcare?
Well, I think that remains to be seen, because we don't know how many of the people who actually are now going to be covered under medical care are actually going to seek medical care. But I think the doctor shortage is looming, and I think it's significant, and I think it's going to be spotty. In some areas of the country, it's not going to be a problem. New York City is over-doctored. Way too many doctors in New York City. But then you go to rural Wisconsin, Indiana, Illinois, all around California, you're going to see a shortage there undoubtedly.
800-462-7413. St. Louis, Missouri now. Hello.
Hi, Tom and Dr. Zorba. I am calling. I am 26 weeks pregnant with my second child.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much. And at around 18 weeks, I had some sharp chest pains and some back pains, and I was assuming it was heartburn, took Tums, it didn't work. I ended up in the emergency room. They did a ultrasound, and they said that I had gallbladder disease and that I had some gallstones and probably had passed one or two. They basically sent me home, told me low-fat diet and go see my doctor. I went to my doctor, and she gave me Pepcid, which I never really took. I haven't had any issues since. But what I'm concerned about is how far along I am now. Is the diet the only thing that's going to help me? Is the low-fat diet the only thing that's going to help me? Am I going to have this forever? If I have another attack, will I need my gallbladder taken out?
Well, first of all, you might have another attack, and that's, okay. Hopefully you won't, but you might have another attack. Gallbladder disease is common in pregnancy. It's a very common thing that women have to deal with along with the pregnancy, and sometimes they actually have to have their gallbladder taken out through a scope while they're pregnant if the gallbladder becomes really diseased, becomes, you know, red hot and inflamed and all those issues surrounding it. So hopefully that won't happen to you, but it is a possibility. Now, diet and gallbladder disease, does it have a role? Well, sort of it has a role. The gallbladder is a repository for bile, and bile is used to emulsify fat. So what happens is, the concept is, if you're on a lower fat diet, you're less likely to actually have problems with your gallbladder. And I think that's a very, very reasonable, natural way to take care of the possibility of that. But you still have the stones in there. And if one gets stuck, then you're in trouble. The Pepcid isn't going to do anything. That's for GERD. That's for gastritis. That's for acid that's in the stomach. It doesn't do anything for gallbladder disease. Sometimes it helps people if they have associated acid in their stomach. So you might need to have it out. Following the diet is a prudent thing to do. Maybe it won't get stuck. But certainly after the baby is out, you ought to have your gallbladder removed, because it'll happen again. So they don't want to do the surgery if they don't have to. So the idea is, let's keep you on a low-fat diet and see. And that's about all. That's about all you can do.
Boy or a girl?
Surprise. We do surprises.
Surprise! I love it.
Names,
I love it.
Names picked out?
No.
Well, let me suggest Zorba. If it's
okay.
I mean,
you
kind of owe him. You know, he gave you this help.
You know, I haven't had anyone name a child after me yet. Thank you, Tom.
We will think of that.
You're so kind.
Very diplomatic, too. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
800-462-7413. Or Tom.
Tom would be okay. There are more Toms than Zorbas, let me tell you that.
Before we take a break, Zorba, let's take a lap over to the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox and see if we can help out Jennifer from Logan, Utah. Jennifer has a 4-year-old daughter who's making trips to the pool very interesting. She writes, whenever we go swimming, she always has to pee. She always goes to the bathroom right before we get to the pool, but minutes after being in the water, she has to use the bathroom again. She has to use the bathroom about 3 times an hour when she's in the water. I don't think she's drinking much water in the pool, if any. Is this normal? Is there a reason for the constant need to urinate when swimming?
Well, I think there's sort of a little psychological aspect to it. She's worried that she's going to pee in the pool, or she just has the sensation of water, and this is not an uncommon thing, and usually kids grow out of it. They usually grow out of it. I mean, they may urinate before they go in the pool, because that's not a bad idea, but they usually grow out of that sensation.
I don't think that's right. I mean, the urge comes to me, too, when I'm in the water.
But ocean, you're not a kid.
Ocean more often than pool for me.
Ocean more often than pool when you're in the water.
I'm happy to say.
But every hour, do you get out?
No, when you jump right in, that's the first thing that comes to mind. Then you have to get out and get back in again.
That's exactly it. So, not unusual, not to worry. She'll probably grow out of it. And you know what? Just make sure you identify the bathroom before you go into the pool.
That's right. And don't swim away from your lifestyle questions. Let us help. Just send your questions to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have our recipe coming up, and after that, more of your calls. Don't forget our medical myth buster late in the hour, all right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI Public Radio International. With Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Back to the phones in a moment, maybe 2 moments. Our recipe first, though, this one for tangy Italian potato salad.
That's right. Do you like potato salad?
Yeah.
I love potato salad, but I don't eat it in the wintertime very often. I eat it in the summertime.
It's a picnic thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's a picnic
thing. You let it sit out in the sun for a while.
That's right, so you can eat it and get sick. It's exactly right. That's what I associate. But the thing about that, by the way, is you don't want to have mayonnaise in your potato salad because it sits out in the sun. It's the mayonnaise, and it's really, it's the salmonella that can be in the mayonnaise from the egg yolk and so on.
Yeah. Also, it isn't that great for you.
No, because it's a high-fat meal. Yeah. Here is a potato salad that doesn't use mayo.
Oh.
It's delicious.
All right.
It's wonderful.
All right.
You should try it.
Let's do it.
Now, what about the potatoes? What kind of potatoes do you use when
little
you make
red
potatoes? I like
absolutely
red potatoes.
Absolutely. Little red potatoes. Yummy.
They look good. They're wonderful. Yeah. I can still remember as a kid, my mother would buy reds, and my Aunt Myrtle, God bless her, may she rest in peace, would buy Idaho's. They would argue all the time over who had better potato salad.
Well,
and
Idaho,
you know who had
is
better
great
potato
for a
salad?
Baked potato, but little red potatoes.
The reds. My mother won hands down.
Absolutely.
That's exactly right. So, and she wasn't Italian. And this is not her recipe, but anyway.
That's a real shock.
It's a shock. Yeah, it's
you look
shock.
So Italian.
I look so Italian. Really. Wouldn't you expect me to be Italian? Yeah. But I'm not Italian.
Okay.
2.5 pounds of red potatoes washed, unpeeled, and chopped into cubes.
2.5 pounds of red potatoes, like Zorba said.
Yeah, that's right. Washed, unpeeled, and chopped
like
into
that.
Cubes. 3 celery stalks.
3 celery stalks.
That's right. 1, obviously chopped. You're going to chop them up.
Yeah.
You're not going to
make
the
whole celery stalk. And
that
wouldn't be too easy to eat. Okay.
That's right. 1 red pepper minced, nice and small.
1 red pepper minced.
That's right. 1/2 cup of green onions sliced.
1/2 cup of sliced green onions.
2 tablespoonfuls of olive oil.
2 big tea olive oil.
1/4 cup of fresh lemon juice.
1/4 cup. Fresh lemon juice.
That's right. I like to use fresh lemon juice. Always tastes better. If not, use the frozen variety, but fresh is best, no doubt.
Right.
1/2 tablespoonful of red vinegar.
1/2 big tea red vinegar.
That's right. Don't use balsamic in here. It would be too strong. 1 tablespoonful of chopped fresh rosemary if you can get it.
Oh, 1 big tea chopped fresh rosemary. That's hard to get?
Yeah, well, sometimes it's hard to get. In stores now, you can often get fresh rosemary. If not, basil would be very good in this. And as a last possibility, a little parsley.
Okay.
But rosemary is the best. 2 cloves of garlic minced.
Two cloves of garlic minced.
And you're going to use, of course, S&P, salt.
Yeah, pepper. Okay.
So boil the potatoes in salted water for 20 minutes, drain them, cool them, then toss the potato chunks with the celery, red pepper, and green onions in a separate bowl. Mm-hmm. Then whisk the oil, lemon juice, vinegar, rosemary, and garlic, and then season that to taste with some salt and pepper. And then bring those both when, if you're going... You know, going to a picnic, bring them both in separate containers. That's what I would do.
Okay.
Because I think it really tastes better if it's mixed right away. And then pour the dressing mix over the potato mix, toss it gently, and serve it at room temperature. But once again, if you're going to go to a picnic, I would bring them separately and I would toss it at the picnic because
well, exactly. What is it in here that is sort of substitutes for the mayonnaise?
Well, that's a good question. If you look at it, the vinegar has a vinegary taste. It's the lemon citrus vinegar. It's really the citrus from the lemon, mm-hmm. and it's really the vinegar that is going to give you the spice, and then you're going to have the aromatics of the rosemary, and then you have garlic. So in other words, what you're doing is you're taking the potato and putting other stuff in the potato that's going to coat it and make it taste good.
Does all that stuff sort of hold it together like the mayonnaise does?
Well, it's not going to appear to be as creamy because there's nothing creamy in here, but it's going to be as tasty because a potato is a fairly bland vegetable.
Well, it's going to be more tasty because who likes mayonnaise?
That's
don't.
Right. I mean, well, not that much. Well, we could have a whole argument. We could have a whole show on mayo because some of us like mayo, well, but we're not going
to
have.
Am
a
I going to listen
mayo.
To that whole show on mayo?
I don't think you will.
So.
You know what? Our listeners aren't going to listen either. Calories: 244 calories. Yeah. Total fat: only 5 grams of fat. It's a great recipe. Try it. Take it on your next picnic. It's wonderful for the Barbie.
Mm-hmm. And if you didn't catch all those ingredients, you can do what, Zorba?
You can come to us on the web at zorbapastor.org. You can find this recipe. You can find our archive recipes, and you can sign up for our weekly podcast. That's zorbapastor.org.
1-800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. Callers waiting and a line open for you. Zorba, back to the phones we go. A listener now in Madison, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help?
Well, I'm actually calling. I'm a 25-year-old. Relatively healthy individual, but I've been recently having a lot of trouble with some pain. From the moment I wake up until, I guess, the time I go to bed, I'm constantly burping. But what comes with that is a continuously full feeling in my chest that's accompanied by a burning feeling, a feeling of a lump in my throat, like I'm about to regurgitate food. The worst pain of all, though, is these sharp pains right under my breastbone that come and go. They're quick, sharp pains, and they come throughout the day.
Hmm.
I went to the doctor for this, and they stated that I had costochondritis and prescribed some naproxen for that.
Hmm.
Unfortunately, though, it didn't eliminate the pain for me. I do currently take Prilosec once a day for acid reflux, and I'm not sure if these pains are related to that. I guess I'm wondering what I can do to relieve this constant pain, and I guess start feeling better.
Yeah, I was going to guess acid reflux before Zorba came in on this because that's what I have right now, but I don't have any pain with that. Is pain associated, Zorba, with acid reflux?
Oh, absolutely. It can be that way. But really, what I think is important here, Tom, is the fact that you relate everything to your diseased or non-diseased state.
Who, tell me, is the center of the world?
That's exactly it. Tom. That's exactly what it is. How does this affect Tom? That's how I always think. Acid reflux. Well, first of all, do you have gas, by the way?
Yes.
You see, yeah.
It's embarrassing.
It's embarrassing. I always thought what I really should write is the acid gas book, you know, how to get rid of acid reflux and gas. I think it would be a bestseller. I'd be on Dr. Oz's show.
But people would have to read it when no one is looking.
That is exactly it. Well, first of all, let's talk about acid. Acid is a really common problem. It does lots of things we never thought before. It causes a chronic cough in some people, causes regurgitation in babies. A lot of babies babies who have colic really have acid reflux. It can cause vocal cord nodules. I had vocal cord nodules from acid reflux a bunch of years ago. And, of course, it can cause pain in the stomach, upper stomach and lower chest. Kind of burning pain, you know, heartburny pain, sometimes kind of sharp. So that's acid.
Mm-hmm.
Now we have costal chondritis. Costal chondritis, we have a bunch of joints in our chest. So we have the breastbone, which if you touch it, it's in the middle of your chest. And then you've got the ribs. And the ribs articulate, that is, they have a joint between that and the breastbone. So when we take a deep breath, the ribs kind of move a little teeny bit, their joints there. And sometimes those joints get inflamed, just like joints in your fingers and your hands and your knees. You can get inflammation with costal chondritis. If that's the case, there is point tenderness over one spot when you push in right where the bone and the breastbone meet. So is there point tenderness there?
Yes, there is. It's nice to have that physical pain to feel that.
Mm-hmm.
Then you're like, well, it's actually something. But yeah, I do have that. Can that be related to acid reflux, or
no,
is that a separate issue?
No. I think you've got two things. Old Dr. Kellogg used to say you've got fleas and lice. Well, he got that. He was in World War II, and people had fleas and lice when he worked there. But yeah, you've got, you like that. So
I
got
do,
related
yeah.
to that's relating it to me, to my past
yep.
history. So you've got acid gas problems on one hand, and you've got costal chondritis. So let's handle them differently. First of all, costal chondritis, if naproxen doesn't work, or, you know, which is over-the-counter Aleve, or ibuprofen, then sometimes you go to a physician. The area above where the pain is numbed, and a little steroid injection can be put right in that joint. Dynamite goes away, disappears, done. And the steroid injections are highly effective 80 to 85% of the time. So if you continue to have that pain and it doesn't go away with time or the naproxen, get an injection.
Okay.
That's number one. Now let's talk about the acid. Do you chew gum?
I do not. I get jaw pain a lot, so
okay.
I don't chew gum.
Okay, because people who chew gum get more gas because as they're chewing gum, they're sucking air in, they're making bubbles, little bubbles and saliva in their gum, and they actually get more gas. So first thing I tell is make sure the gum. I know dentures are not a problem in your 20s, so dentures can be a problem.
Don't get there.
What I would do is immediately double the dose of Prilosec. It's very
okay.
good. I would go to 40 milligrams a day from 20. They're all over-the-counter 20s. And if that fails, I would go to the new over-the-counter kit on the block, Pepcid. Pepcid was great. Prilosec is the one that's been there.
Prevacid.
But Prevacid is the new one. Pepcid is
Prevacid milking. Is what I'm taking now.
Right, and Prevacid is a drug that was a very commonly used prescription drug, which is now over-the-counter, and I would take 30 milligrams. That's 2 15-milligram tablets, and I would do that if the Prilosec fails.
And if that doesn't work, there are half a dozen other drugs, aren't they?
Right, there are a bunch of other drugs, as Tom said, that are prescription drugs that'll work. So I would try one after the other. I like to go to the cheapest first because they're usually just as good. 40 of Prilosec. 30 a Prevacid. See if that works, and if it doesn't work, give us a call.
And now, is that quick question? Is the gas associated with acid reflux? Then?
Most likely. That
okay.
most likely. If you get the acid reflux under control, most people can get gas under control, but not completely. And as I said, I'm in the middle of writing my book, The Acid Gas Handbook. So you call me back, and we'll give you gas advice.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thanks for the call. Will you dedicate it to me?
Absolutely. Dedicate it to my friend Tom Clark. And then I'll have to have a nice little, you know, sexy line after that about acid and gas.
800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. And before the break, Zorba, let's allow you to change hats for another Judge Zorba case. Today's case deals with eggs, so let's get down to the yolk of the matter.
Oh, gosh.
Laura from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, is concerned over a ruling her mother recently made and wants to appeal to Judge Zorba for the final verdict. She writes, "Every morning, I fry an egg for breakfast, and I always break the yolk because I like it to be cooked all the way through. My mom told me the other day that breaking the yolk is carcinogenic. Does breaking the yolk cause cancer.
Oh, my gosh. Where do you think that came from? I mean, I hope the mother's not listening to the show, but why would cooking the yolk be carcinogenic? You know, it's a good example of stuff that's out there on the web that has absolutely no meaning at all. No, actually, making sure the yolk is cooked and making sure that the egg white is cooked is good because it protects us from salmonella. So a lot of restaurants will not serve eggs sunny side up because they're worried that there's salmonella in the yolk and, of course, in the egg white also. So the answer is no. It's no yolk, or maybe it is a yolk.
On the other hand, if you break the yolk while you're making the fried egg, would you end up with a scrambled egg?
Yeah. Well, but yes.
I mean, who wants a fried egg with a yolk broken?
You've got it. Exactly. That's right. It doesn't taste as good. So Tom, who's a member of the Taste Police, says don't break the yolk. But breaking the yolk or not breaking the yolk, it's not carcinogenic.
Yeah, got it. If your lifestyle debate is getting scrambled, send your appeal to Judge Zorba. Just send your affidavit or email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Now, hang on. We're going to have some interesting research to talk about. More of your calls coming up and our medical Mythbuster, too, right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our phone number again, 800-462-7413. But before our next call, Zorba, some talk about tanning salons and what you called tanaholics?
Tanaholics. That's right, tanaholics. Well, first of all, let's talk about tanning salons. Mm-hmm. Is tanning safe?
Sure.
No, it's not safe. Tanning is not safe.
In limited amounts.
Tanning is not safe. Going out in the sun, having a great time, and not getting a tan is actually safer. We know that tanning isn't safe. Now the issue
is driving safe?
No.
Okay, well then tanning isn't safe.
How about getting in an airplane? Is getting in an airplane
safe? No. Well, yes, it is safer than driving.
Yeah, safer than driving.
And so are tanning salons, I bet.
Yeah, but there's some issues. The feds are looking at it, and they're actually going to say that, they've said, of course, there's a risk of cancer and so on. But a lot of people know the tanning. Now, what about excessive tanning? You're going in for 20 treatments and 30 treatments and 40 treatments. Is that addictive behavior?
It's probably more dangerous the more you do.
Well, that's exactly it. Yeah. And some people may go before they're going to the beach and they want to get a little tan started, but they found that people who go in for chronic tanning often have more anxiety, are more likely to abuse alcohol, and this may be part of the addictive behavior.
Oh, and they're more urged to tan again soon?
Well, that's exactly the question. They're more urged. As soon as some of these people get out of the tanning booth, they feel like they need to have UV, you know, ultraviolet rays and go back in the tanning booth because they don't feel good unless they have the continuous
like a cigarette.
Like a cigarette.
Wow.
Like I have to have a drink of
alcohol.
Are you
sure? Is this?
Well, but this is kind of the issue of whether or not there really are tan addicts and whether or not we should be treating tanning for people who go in chronic tanning as an addiction. Now I mention this. I mean, you laugh about this.
I do.
But the fact is, if you know that something may be addiction, you may then begin to say, do I really want to go in and get a tan or am I engaged in addictive behavior? It may allow you the opportunity to actually change that versus I've got to keep my skin brown, otherwise everyone's going to, you know, get upset with me because I don't have the usual tan skin.
Did you really say that they're more likely to be alcoholics?
Absolutely. Well, the issue is they appear to be more likely to abuse alcohol in this most recent study, more likely to engage in regular marijuana use on a very regular basis once or twice a week, and they're more likely to engage in other behaviors that are also associated with anxiety. In other words, tanning may be the way that they're treating anxiety when, in fact, there may be better methods of treating anxiety.
Wow.
So Wow is exactly it. So in other words, a tan is not a tan is not a tan. In other words, going to a tanning booth before you're going to go to the beach may be one thing, but getting tans where you're going in 10, 20, 30 visits may be actually a symptom of other addictive behaviors. And knowing that may allow people to seek behavioral care for that to make them happier.
1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number, 800-462-7413. Let's see, Zorba, if we can help a listener now in El Paso, Texas. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
We appreciate that call. How can we help you?
Well, I'm a 69-year-old person, and I'm going to South Africa next month.
Really? To where in Africa?
Well, I'm going to the Kruger National Park, mm-hmm. and then Johannesburg, and then Cape Town.
Wow.
And I've looked forward to this for a long time.
I'll bet you do. Now, what's your question for Zorba?
Okay, my question is that I have been taking vaccinations and vaccines and stuff for about 3 months now. And when it came to the meningitis vaccine, I was told by everybody, the health department and like that, that I was too old to take the meningitis vaccine that was available, that what I really ought to do is take this other meningitis vaccine that no one knows where is. Well, I'm going to be in South Africa in 16 days. It's too late now. But what I really want to know is what's the difference between the meningitis vaccine for you young whippersnappers and for pleasantly aging little old ladies, you know.
I'll tell you what it is. First of all, when we look at meningitis, there are a couple of different vaccines that are actually out there. And the meningitis vaccine that we now give to young adults and to teenagers is really for the meningitis that that seems to affect them. And for reasons that we don't quite understand, is not likely to affect adults. And it affects kids in college dorms. It is a disastrous disease when it happens because often they get sick and 24 hours later they can be on a ventilator and they can be dead. So what we've now recommended in the last few years is to have that particular meningitis vaccine. There's some other vaccines that are out there, but it's really parsing the difference. And I don't know why one vaccine would be superior to another vaccine. The real issue is, if you're going to South Africa and you're visiting, is to pay attention to what you should do to make sure that you don't get malaria, which is a major problem all over the world, especially in sub-Saharan Africa. And the way to find out what you should do, and obviously you've gotten some information, is to go to cdc.gov, that's cdc.gov, and there's a traveler's health section, which is dynamite. You push a button, it opens up a screen, you look up South Africa, and those are the recommendations that we all follow. That's one of the issues. The other issue is to have Cipro, C-I-P-R-O, an antibiotic that we give for traveler's diarrhea with you when you're there, because you drop Cipro and you take 2 tablets a day for 2 to 3 days, and you'll get rid of traveler's diarrhea. And basically, I always recommend people, now the bottled water is pretty much easy to get no matter where you travel, you take bottled water. You know, moderately, you look at what you're eating in restaurants, but as long as you don't eat off the street, you're probably at less risk, but it's not no risk at all. And finally, enjoy yourself. You're going to be there. Make sure you put on sunscreen. Have a good time. But sometimes one injection can still give you some protection, even though you need an injection often. And for many immunizations, you need the second one as a booster. The first one still gives you protection. So my recommendation is if that vaccine is on the list, get one shot. You'll get protection. But once again, these risks are so small and so minimal.
What about the idea of being too old to get medicine?
Well, there's certain vaccines that the CDC doesn't recommend because your risk is so minimal. Oh. So even though the risk is minimal, if you want to get the vaccine, you go to your doctor and you say, I want to get the vaccine. The other issue is that Medicare only pays for certain vaccines, so you may be stuck with a bill. So check that out first. But if it's not on the CDC site, that means the risk is so small that you're more likely to get into a car crash and die from that than the disease itself.
Are you going on a tour?
I'm going on a safari.
Uh-huh.
And by the way, I've had all of the other shots and vaccines, and I have a package of anti-malaria things to start taking just before I go. So
that's what counts.
Have a great time.
I will. Thank you so much.
And thank you so much for the call, and thank you so much. When's the last time, Zorba, you were called a young whippersnapper? It's been a couple of years for me.
It's been a while.
800-462-7413. Zorba, let's get to our medical myth buster now. We have a listener myth today that may bring new meaning to the term blue blood. It comes to us from Gary in Snohomish, Washington. Gary writes, after hearing experts from both sides of the fence, I'm totally confused and am turning to the authority of public radio before I continue giving the wrong information to my seventh grade life science students. I've told my students that all blood is red. Some appears blue because we see it through our skin, but in reality, it is truly red. Don't blame me. My expertise is in rocks and stars. In preparing for our circulatory system lessons this year, however, I came across a reputable site, the Mayo Clinic, that actually states that blood lacking in oxygen is blue. Dr. Zorba, please clear this up before I further stunt the intellectual growth of my students and continue contributing to an urban legend.
Well, first of all, cut your skin, blood is red, right?
Yeah.
That's very simple. Cut the vein, the blood will appear to be more bluish. Hold your breath. What happens to your face? You become more bluish, and that's because of the buildup of carbon dioxide. And if we look at our veins, and our veins are closer to our skin, there's a different wall in the vein than in the artery. If you look at it, the reason why it's blue is that the oxygen has been taken out of the blood, and it is more bluish. It is not actually blue. You don't actually – you've never cut and seen yourself bleed. You don't actually bleed blue, but it is more bluish. So as carbon dioxide goes into the blood, it becomes more bluish. As carbon dioxide is out of the blood, it becomes more reddish. It has nothing to do with oxygen, just has to do with carbon dioxide. And as a science teacher, that gives you a chance to talk about carbon dioxide and drive home global warming.
Have an urban legend you'd like Zorba to bust. Just send it to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
And those of you who want to debate the global warming issue, email Zorba. Don't talk to me. 800-462-7413. And a listener now in Andersonville, Tennessee. Hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great. How can we help?
Sometimes when I eat celery, my tongue goes numb. And it doesn't happen all the time, and it happens to varying degrees. But when I went to look it up on the internet, I found several different explanations. So I was wondering what your explanation would be.
What'd you find on the internet? That's what I want to know.
The first thing I found said that it was caused by phototoxicity, which I thought, that's a little strange.
That's a little strange. I agree with that. So we'll throw out, we'll take it. All right, phototoxicity.
It's gone,
out.
Yeah.
The second one said that it was a food allergy.
Food allergy. Okay, now, but you don't have any hives, and
no.
So it'd be unlikely to be a food allergy.
And okay. I kept eating celery because I'm like, well, nothing really strange and scary happens. It's
yeah, and I must tell you, we don't see many people with food allergies. We see, from when it comes to celery,
yeah.
We see people with seafood allergies, but not celery allergies. Okay,
right, exactly.
What's next?
And then the third explanation that I found was a chemist who was on a website talking about the physical composition of celery and that it contained numbing properties.
Well, that the physical composition, I would think, is the most likely explanation. And it may be when we talk about the physical, physically what celery is, it may also be the fact that celery, it's not just the constitution chemically, but what it is, it's actually a hard vegetable and it may be pushing on the tongue and actually causing something to happen in the nerves in the tongue. That's probably the most likely thing. You know, not being the repository of all knowledge in medicine, when I was in medical school, we never had a celery discussion. We actually had very little in nutrition, but from a point of view of celery, which we like the crunch of, but has minimal nutrients in it. I don't remember ever going to a celery lecture. So I probably, if I were looking for this, would do exactly what you did, and I would throw away all the junky stuff that wouldn't make sense on the web, or people who want to eat celery and are selling me, you know, a drop that you put on your tongue beforehand. I bet it is the composition, and it may be some reaction to the composition of either the chemicals that are in there. But I'll tell you the good thing about public radio. The fact is that we're talking about celery now. We will be inundated with emails from people telling us about their celery problems, and we will share them with you at the earliest time that we can do that.
Well, yeah, I actually went on Facebook and, you know, posted something about it one day and said, should I really keep eating this? And then it was like, you know, a secret society, you know, that people came on and were like, hey, I have that problem sometimes too. And I was like, huh, it's not just me. Well,
it's the secret celery society that no one ever talks about, but is always the elephant in the room.
Until you're a member of it. Exactly. Thank you so much.
Sure, we appreciate the call. Before we punch out for the week, Zorba, let's tie up a loose end. On a previous show, you used the phrase pig in a poke and then immediately asked our listeners to tell you what it meant. And I didn't have a clue either, as you'll recall.
Yes, of course.
Our dutiful listeners, though, answered in droves with the origin of the phrase, summed up well by John in Green Bay. John writes, my source is an interesting book called A Hog on Ice by Charles Funk that gives the origin of a lot of fun phrases. Funk says, the phrase came from the old practice of carrying to market a small pig in a sack slung over the shoulder, the poke. The seller would sometimes substitute a cat for a pig and try and have the buyer buy without looking inside because you know how hard those pigs are to catch.
Oh, I've got it.
Therefore, buying sight unseen is like buying a pig in a poke. Now, a smart buyer would demand a look, therefore letting the cat out of the bag. Who would have thought those two sayings were related?
Well, that's exactly why we listen to public radio, to learn something. But you know what they didn't have that we have today? So
what?
It wouldn't happen. Craigslist.
Okay. Now, if you have a suggestion for Zorba or want to enlighten us about something, email us at
Zorba@WPR.org.
Zorba, we'll see you next week.
Take care, Tom, and stay well.
If you've missed anything during the show or just want to download our recipe podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org.
And don't forget, you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. Adam Friedrich and Brad Kohlberg, who often get confused for Captain and Tennille, are the two guys keeping this show together. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, wanting you to be with us on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0501Z. More on healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, show archives, and listener feedback, is available online at ZorbaPastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.